Hello, Futurelings. This is Ken.
And this is John.
We're going to take a second here before the show begins to celebrate the holiday winter solstice season.
The solstice.
The solstice, we call it. It's like the Soviets.
The poultice.
If you put a poultice on a Soviet because he's turning red, it's a solstice. Just to mention that with the advent of the holiday season in late November 2019.
I like how you threw advent in there. That's nice.
Yeah, it's just a lot of subtle Christianity every time I talk. I'm offended by the Starbucks cups that don't have a manger on them.
Every day I open a little door in Ken and I get another tiny piece of chocolate.
You know, we were so thankful for your support around the Thanksgiving season that we, after months of putting it off, we finally rolled out a series of delightful benefits and rewards for those who have supported the show.
We've been so grateful for the Patreon support of our program. It has eased our transition away from our former corporate masters and made us feel like independent operators and futurelings ourselves. And so we wanted to give back in this time of giving and actually have Patreon levels that have different rewards.
So give yourself the gift of perks this holiday season.
What are some of our perks, Ken?
Well, anybody who donates at any of the Patreon tiers receives probably the main perk, which is a monthly omnibus episode of Addenda that goes reader feedback, pointing out corrections and additions and addictions, possibly.
Yeah. A lot of presentlings have information they'd like to share with us about various topics. Sometimes it's because they live in the town that we discussed. Sometimes it's because they are lapidiatrists.
If there's one thing all omnibus listeners have in common, it's they have information to share.
So we
wanted to make sure that went in the time capsule.
That's right. We're going to cover all the bases, and so it's a fun listen, a fascinating listen.
A new monthly episode available to all our donors at higher donation levels. You get access to a video, a image archive. Show notes and mailbag oddities and whatnot.
You're going to be astonished by the difference between our show notes.
Mine are in pencil and John's are in ink.
That's, yeah, basically it.
That's the main.
Ken's are legible and mine are not.
John's have pentagrams
they
on them.
Often do.
At even higher tiers, you can get an autographed copy of those show notes mailed to you or even the ability to choose a show topic and rocket your preferred omnibus idea to the top of the queue.
Yeah, we're going to try and make that as difficult as possible for you to achieve, but it is a perk.
It may be collaborative if your idea is terrible or offensive, or even video chats with the two of us. So go to patreon.com/omnibusproject, see what tempts you, what tickles your fancy, what craveable new benefits there are for you to enjoy.
Crave.
My favorite word.
Moist.
Happy holidays, everyone.
Receiving this message. We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus.
You have accessed entry 767.JB2415, certificate number 29692, the Max Headroom Intrusion.
This is Max Headroom, and what you're about to witness is one of the most sinister-sounding intros to a trailer to one of the greatest epics ever produced in the history of television. And there's more, because you are going to see it as well.
Yes, it.
Yes, it. Yes, namely, the Maxedrum Syndrome story.
You, as a computer guy, must have some... As a computer guy.
I'm a computer-generated guy.
As a computer guy. You must have some opinion or some relationship to hacking, hacking as a concept, hacking as a philosophy.
No. Next question.
You have none. You haven't generated any opinions about hacking?
I'm annoyed by it.
Are you?
Like, even if you work as a computer programmer, you're primarily a user of other people's products.
Mm-hmm.
You don't just, do the thing where you crack your knuckles back and then twiddle your fingers and then just start typing into a mainframe command line and
rewrite the encryption.
Computer science. Yeah, we're going to find a back door into the seashell. No. So I'm annoyed when my stuff doesn't work.
Right.
And so I associate hackers with products and incidents and pranks that make my stuff not work. Malware and spyware and viruses and worms. And I'm aware that there's a whole kind of anarchist culture built around these amazing heroes, but I'm just annoyed by their work.
How do you feel about culture jamming in general as a concept? I mean, the idea being that there's a mainstream culture, which is exclusive and walled off, and that mainstream culture promotes and promulgates a certain ideology.
The status quo.
That's right. The man. And that the only way for those of us who are excluded, and those of us, I flatter myself, excluded from mainstream culture, the only way to gain access to the eyes and ears of the masses, and this I think was much more of a prevalent mentality before there was an internet that
right.
Amplified any voice.
For the first time, we're living in an age where you can culture jam just by starting a podcast or a vlog or a YouTube channel.
Right. One could say that we were culture jammers, although I don't think anyone would say that.
I don't think we should say that.
But it's still even in this world of like incredibly proliferated channels and access to whomever you can attract, it still is a common trope that there is. That there's a mainstream culture that is not that's controlled and that is broadcasting a sophisticated and exclusive ideology that has brainwashed the majority
and with a bad aesthetic, right? It's watered down pablum. It's not good for us.
Right.
It's gruel,
spoon fed.
It doesn't even
garbage.
Matter if it's dumb or malicious.
It's mostly driven by the needs and desires of advertisers and the advertising industry, the ultimate bad guy in our media world.
That's why, to me, public radio is the ultimate culture jamming. Not beholden to advertisers.
Yeah.
I feel like a bit of a bad boy when I listen to Like Will Be Gone or whatever.
Nightline? No, Nightline.
No,
that's a mainstream
ABC,
broadcast.
That's
right?
Disney. That's the biggest conglomerate in the world.
Sorry. Well, we've talked about it before, but in the 70s and 80s and 90s even, there was an underground culture of people that really were trying to subvert not only the dominant paradigm, but even some less dominant
some
paradigms.
Some B or C level paradigms? What would you say were the runner-up paradigms of the 70s and 80s?
I think the runner-up paradigms were often it was the local level of, as you say, watered-down, kind of mealy-mouthed imitations of the sort of global network of corporate media domination.
So not Saturday Night Live, but like SCTV.
Well, no, those guys were culture jammers, considered that. No, I'm talking about like local news programs and your local Pontiac dealer that's buying ads that are, crowding out your anarchist messages, but also
what could be more anarchist than Crazy Mike? He's slashing all prices,
and that, and I mean, this is a, that's a, I think, a valid critique of the idea that there is a monolithic media, because of course, I mean, the benefit of an advertising culture is that you can buy, if you have the money, you can buy an ad on any one of these local television programs and put your mega church up there. Or, I mean, it's just a question of, is that how you want to spend your cash? But you could buy a, I worked at a television station. It was my first job.
I didn't know you worked at, you worked in local TV.
I did.
What did you do?
Well, it was a little bit of a culture jam. in the mid-80s.
I can't wait to see how you were disrupting Anchorage TV.
Well, just wait. In the mid-80s, there was, with the rise of MTV and the popularity of it, there was briefly an idea that there was room in the culture sphere for local 24-hour music television stations.
Oh, local VJs.
Local VJs. And so in several locations around the country, including Anchorage, UHF 24-hour music video stations opened. And in Anchorage, it was called Catch 22, and it was on UHF Channel 22. And it was – it
did you get a cease and desist from the Joseph Heller estate?
No, I don't think I ever did. At the time, there wasn't anything on UHF. I don't even remember. I mean, I remember looking at the UHF dial on our old dial TVs and wondering what the heck it was even there for.
Well, in Alaska, you would just flip through station after station of snow, and you wouldn't be able to know if it was an actual outside video feed of snow.
We had 100 different words for,
for UHF
stations. But Catch 22 opened, to great local fanfare.
Really?
And it had a 24-hour feed.
Was it all local Alaskan music videos?
Well, no, it was, I mean, we had a library on, it was broadcast standard VHS tapes. So they weren't.
It's like those oversized ones.
Yeah, right? They're oversized, right? They weren't the consumer ones. And we acquired a library of music videos. Now, they weren't all – we didn't have all of the good music videos. A lot of them were, second
rate.
You had
bought a library of public domain.
No, and we were getting new videos all the time.
Sure, because record companies would send those out even to these local stations, I assume.
That's right.
They want to get airplay.
And I should give a shout-out right now to a listener of the Omnibus in our present day, a futureling – but a presentling.
Confusing.
Whose name is Richard Hadley, and he's actually active on our Facebook page. Richard was the program director of Catch 22 in Anchorage. He was a transplant from the great state of Iowa, and one of these characters that was in Iowa wondering what to do after having graduated from his corn agra college program or whatever.
I majored in corn.
And he was a member of the rockabilly subculture. And he and a good friend moved to Anchorage as part of their Western exploration.
Did Anchorage have an amazing rockabilly scene?
It did not.
Yet.
And so these two guys were very colorful characters. They showed up in Anchorage with their slicked up pompadour haircuts and their they wore creepers, I think, and they had, they're pretty stylish dudes, or, stylish as far as rockabilly goes, right? I mean,
is that a low bar for style?
I think it's right in there. It's right up there with ska.
Many other genre style begins where rockabilly style leaves off.
But these two characters, like, they bought a 54 Chevy, which, only had one headlight, and somehow they got this job. Sort of starting Catch 22, they weren't like the business people behind it. They were the first on-air personalities.
Did Richard hire you?
He did. And so I was in high school and Catch 22 came on the air and I was just rapt with the idea that it wasn't a good television station, but it was what we all dreamt of, which was you had a local path to becoming a VJ, the greatest of all jobs.
I could ride my bike over to here.
And I did ride my bike to work. And I went in, and I've never done another thing like this in life, but I wanted so desperately to be a VJ on Catch 22 that I rode my bike there, and it was not close to my house, every day. And I sat in the lobby with my VHS tape that I had made.
You made an audition tape.
Of me going like, hey, Anchorage, you know, how's it going? And I sat there, and there was a receptionist, and she was like exactly what you would imagine the receptionist of a startup television station in Anchorage, Alaska. Like, she was young and vivacious, but, you know, and super friendly, but also, I mean, it was absolutely like WKRP type situation. And she would say, Richard's busy. He'll see you in, you know, he'll see you in a minute. And then Richard Hadley would always escape out a side door, and at the, you know, and I would sit in the lobby, and she would say, oh, he's left on an important mission. And I would, you know, go home and come back the next day. And I did it relentlessly until one day Richard Hadley came out from his, you know, his glass-walled office in the back.
He forgot you were there.
No. He knew I was there. He was purposely ignoring me. Oh, you're saying he forgot I was there that one day. No, I'd given the videotape. It was one of these things where he kept waiting for me to just get tired and stop coming.
Les Nessman would never do that.
And eventually he was like, all right, I'll see your videotape. And then he watched it. And it was terrible, right? It was terrible. I set up a VHS camera across the room and tried to be Nina Hagen.
I'm imagining you walking into the frame at the beginning of it.
With my, you know, like,
after having hit start on the camera.
My rubber chicken in one hand. And and he said, all right, listen, I'll give you a job, but here are the conditions. One, you never skip school. If I ever catch you skipping school, you're fired. And the second one was, he said, you can never actually, your face can never appear on air. Your voice can. You can do voiceovers, but you're just going to be like working the technical stuff, you know, the switching and stuff. And I was like, fine, I'll take the job. And then it became clear that what he wanted was, he needed somebody to do the overnight shifts. Nobody wanted to do the 1 a.m. to 8 a.m. shift at a local UHF television station.
Well, he shouldn't have been having a high school junior doing it.
I know. Like, it's true. I was 16.
Don't you have a geometry test in the morning?
I was 16. And so I did. I did overnights on weekends. Mm. And also that was where he relegated the country music show and the rap show.
So he liked every kind of music?
So except I did like a four-hour country show and a four-hour rap show on nights on weekends.
Does this explain your deep love today of
country and rap? And country rap crossover.
That's your main field of interest.
Yeah, that.
We call you Kid Roderick. Kid Roderick.
But it happened, this was in the, excuse me, this was in the mid-80s when this type of, when this type of thing felt like the future, and it felt like Catch 22 was culture jamming. It was the first time anybody in Alaska had ever seen a rockabilly person, presumably. But also there was a guy named Frank Harlan who was an Anchorage punk rocker who had a zine called Warning, the Warning fanzine, which was like when Warning came out, every alternative kid in Anchorage scrambled to get a copy of this fanzine that was talking about, you know, punk rock. And Frank had a show called Bomb Shelter Videos where he played punk rock videos. And even after Catch 22 fell apart, Frank moved to Seattle and his Bomb Shelter Videos was on public access TV down here. And he became kind of a, I don't know if I'm going to say tastemaker, but he was a media, local subterranean media personality for a long time.
So the thing about culture jamming is often the thrill of it is that it's illicit, right? You're getting away with something.
Well, you imagine
that. And that's not true here. I mean, these guys, I'm sure, were selling local ads for local mattress
firms
on there.
But the idea being that if you expose people, and we see this, I think, throughout our culture, the idea that if you expose people to something outside their comfort zone, something radical, that alone might be enough to shake the foundations of their tenuous grip on normality.
You got to wake up the sheeple.
That's right. And having done it, having destabilized them with one Agent Orange video or one, you know, sort of even a snarky comment from a VJ from Iowa who's arrived in Anchorage and doesn't really understand or care about the local culture, that is going to be enough to maybe radicalize somebody and turn them into an art consumer, somebody who's seeking out, you know, alternative history or seeing a different side of politics. That could be transformative, that could change the world.
I guess that's true. If you imagine the young audience for this kind of thing, those are the people. Because I think generally exposure to this kind of thing more often than not just calcifies a culture. Like, yep, I was right. I didn't like punk rock. What is this on Channel 22?
That's right.
But you're right that there's a small group of vulnerable young people that you can trick.
Well, yeah.
I should say influence.
Influence.
And you could set them on a different path because you probably are cooler than what's on than the Bewitched reruns on Channel 7.
And I think you're absolutely right. By the time someone is a middle-aged mom and dad living in a Levitt town somewhere, the idea that Frank Harlan coming on and you know, waving a rubber chicken in front of them on their UHF station is not going to cause them to stop believing in Jesus.
They're not all going to have a mohawk the next day.
But they're kids looking around for something that's going to
piss off mom and dad.
Piss off mom and dad. Right, you can reach them and maybe change their course. I mean, the only thing I knew about rockabilly was the Stray Cats going in, but becoming friends with Richard, I briefly knew the names of a couple other rockabilly bands that I've since forgotten. But I did develop an affection at least for that culture. I know it, I never bought a pair of Creepers, but I know what they are.
At least it didn't set you on a permanent path of rockabilly rebellion.
No. And that's...
You later chose your own path, but you had options.
I did. I had options.
It wasn't just whatever, your parents' Perry Como records.
Well, and I learned that I really liked bluegrass. Because I had...
Because you had to do the bluegrass show.
I had to do the bluegrass show. And I learned about the Telluride Bluegrass Festival. But, you know, I already liked rap. So doing the rap show was actually pretty fun. And I would get phone calls from people in the community calling up and requesting videos. And I learned all about video production.
So you guys got requests?
Oh, yeah. People would call up and say, you know, critique videos. I mean, they're just watching local music videos in the middle of the night. And this is the thing, right? Cable TV was not universally affordable for people. So This was an opportunity to have a local MTV that was free.
I remember thinking cable TV was a terrible idea. My grandparents had it and there was an extra box. Wait, you have to use a box to watch TV? Yeah. Hard pass. We have TV at our house and there's no box.
There was briefly. So Anchorage had the original, before cable, before wired cable, there was an era of... like microwave transmitted premium television. And in Anchorage, it was called Visions. And Visions required that you have a special antenna. And it wasn't a dish. It was kind of shaped like a corn cob. And it was up on a pole. And you could drive around Anchorage and tell which houses had Visions. And if you had Visions, it was, you know, that was premium. And it was HBO. But it was only one channel, right? So for a while it would show HBO and then it would show something from Showtime and then it would show, you know, it had, Visions had its own programming, which was a combination of first run movies and then at night it would show like softcore.
Like Cinemax?
Cinemax kind of, you know, they're not even dirty movies with the real dirty stuff cut out. There was a genre in the... Yeah. 70s and early 80s of movies that had racy parts, but they also had plots. Not great plots. They were really terribly acted. You had to find a kind of actor who wanted to act, but also was willing to take their clothes off and simulate intercourse.
You had to be interested in both Red Shoes and Diaries, and then you could do this kind of thing.
Yeah, so it wasn't like, I don't think... There are a lot of great actors that got their start there. I think probably if you were going to either go to Hollywood or go into porn, you generally like slid into porn.
These are people who wanted a middle way. I'm a reasonable centrist. I see the virtues of both show business and pornography.
They wanted to be able to tell their mom and dad that they were an actor. Mm-hmm. And hopefully their folks would never see their films. Or maybe they'd send the film home on VHS with the racy bits cut out.
How long would Dangerous Desires 3 even be if you cut out the 20-minute simulated?
The Great Texas Dynamite Chase is one film I remember.
So this was a premium subscription kind of service? You'd pay a monthly fee to get your corn cob?
Yep, and they would put the corn cob up on your roof, and everyone in Anchorage would know that you had visions.
Your sons will have dreams and your daughters will have visions?
But briefly at my dad's house, somebody in the close proximity to us had visions. And if you turned the TV between channel 13
so it wasn't its own band
and UHF, it was some amount of that microwave signal got into a regular TV antenna, and I could watch visions.
Now, you're miming that you're actually holding the analog dial between the two, and that's what you would have to do?
You had to put, you know, because analog dials would go click, thunk, right. And so if you got between channel 13 and the UHF and kind of balanced it there, you could watch visions.
This is the oldest you have ever sounded to anyone listening. I have a slideshow I do for elementary schools where I show like a game show playing on an old timey TV because I'm talking about my childhood. And it's not an old timey TV. It's just it's a 1980 Zenith or Magnavox or something. And the kids will literally ask, why would you watch TV on a microwave? Because they have never seen a television set with wooden veneer and physical dials.
What's crazy is when Anchorage did get cable TV and got those television top boxes, the little metal box that was the interface, the boxes came with a key that you could lock certain channels. You could have the Playboy channel, but keep your kids from watching it by having this key in the side that if you turned it and pulled the key out, whatever channels you decided to make off limits to your kids, they couldn't see.
It was a physical mechanical thing.
A key that
because there was not enough electronics in the TV to do it any other way.
Right. You kept it on a string around your neck that was the key to the hot channels.
It's my Playboy key.
But someone, some kid, and I have no idea this is one of the great mysteries in my life.
Let's solve it right now.
Cable came into Anchorage, and within a very short amount of time, the rumor went around my high school. If you take the security key out of the lock and you stick it in the fourth vent hole from the left in the back of the box, it will short circuit it and you can get all the channels.
I don't buy this for a second.
It 100% is true.
It worked? You could somehow, through the vent hole, you could reach something that would short circuit the
short circuit the controls. So
imagine how that was discovered.
That's the mystery. How was that? What kid took the key out of the side and started sticking it in the vent holes in the back?
I mean, the thing about teenage boys is, you know, when you're horny, you will just try every hole.
But and you remember this when channels that you didn't subscribe to were digitally scrambled. So
sure. It would be kind of a weird double image.
Yeah,
and the colors would be
colors were all crazy. Off sync, and you couldn't quite make out the picture, although you could see that there was a picture behind it. Mm-hmm. Somehow this key in the back of the box stopped that. And I don't know how that worked. I don't know how from their local headquarters they were sending a signal to the box that scrambled certain channels and not others.
You're doing this to the box, not the set, right?
To the box, so not the TV set.
So everybody's got the same box.
Yeah, and everybody could take the key out, stick it in the fourth hole over. It didn't work in any of the other holes. And once you did it, it eliminated the digital interference and you could watch perfectly.
Who was that hero? It almost, it's so perfect. It almost seems like it, speaking of culture jamming and hacking, maybe it was some back door. Like, did the designer put in a secret way to override the jam?
I have considered all of these possibilities that this was somebody who, you know, said to his younger cousin, like, look, I work at the cable company and here's the secret. And we did it. Who knows why? But for 2 years, every teenager in Anchorage could get all the channels, and no one ratted it out.
This is why you're such a libertine. It's not just you. There's a whole, you have a whole cohort of depraved people like you, probably.
From
your untrammeled access to Playboy After Dark.
Well, and what it required was that your parents did not use the system, because if they took the key, then the key was gone, right? So your parents had to be the ones that just didn't subscribe to the dirty channels.
You had the most goody-goody parents.
Yeah, right. So if your parents just got the basic cable, they left the key in the box. Because
think of those heartbroken parents. We did everything right. We didn't even get Cinemax, and somehow little Bobby.
The thing is, the parents never knew about it. Well, it was
do now.
It was a universal kid conspiracy to have free cable. It was. I still marvel at it.
This should be a movie. Like there should be a movie of this.
Well, I'm not sure that it's a thick enough plot to sustain a whole feature.
Then something happens. Here, this, I'm thinking like a screenwriter now. What I would do is I would have something happen.
Oh, sure.
Right?
Well, you get sucked into the box and then you live in a TV world.
I wasn't going to do this
with
sci-fi
Max
twist.
Headroom, who also got sucked into a box.
So speaking of culture jamming, Max Headroom.
Max. Prior to Max Headroom, let's go back to a time even before Visions, when there was only the three stations on TV and PBS, ABC, CBS, and NBC, and PBS. The four stations that those of us who are old enough to remember a time before Facebook, that defined our childhoods. It's why you were so good at Jeopardy. You had one channel.
Before Infinite TV.
Yeah.
Before literally every TV idea. It's like the multiple universes conceit. Every possible universe now exists as a streaming TV show. But that was not the case.
Not the always. Case. Right. Although you cannot watch the Studio Ghibli movies anywhere, as far as I can tell.
That's true.
Do you know a place? Do you know where I can watch Spirited Away? Without owning a DVD player?
Speaking of culture jamming, before those were widely available in the U.S., I bought pirated discs.
You did?
Of that. Is that really culture jamming? No, they're no. Children's cartoons.
No, that's just...
That's just consumer fraud.
Yeah, that's just stealing.
I just stole money from the geniuses who produced the art.
You know, video piracy is not a victimless crime, Ken.
No, it's actually good for the artist. It creates an audience. Haven't you heard?
Well, there is an audience for Studio Ghibli movies. I am it, and I cannot find them. They don't stream. They're owned by some subcommittee of Disney.
Just by physical optical discs.
Yeah. I don't have a DVD player.
Is that right?
I don't watch TV on the microwave.
Just hold it up to the light then, and watch things shimmer on the circles
in Totoro. I can't
put Totoro,
a key in the back of that. In 1977... in the United Kingdom, one fateful night in, I guess, November, the television broadcast, the BBC broadcast, was spookily interrupted. The screen started to flicker.
I am V for Vendetta.
Almost exactly that.
Really?
A voice came on and said, "This is Vrillon."
Vrillon?
Of the space...
Was it Darth Vader from Planet Vulcan?
of the Space Imperial Order of, you know, Advanced Civilizations. And very super spooky voice. And Vrillon proceeded to... You could still see the flickering image of the normal newscaster. But Vrillon intoned on and on.
Oh, so you were just hearing his voice.
Just hearing his voice.
Audio-only intrusion.
Yeah. He spoke at length for 5 minutes or so.
What were his demands?
In a British voice.
Or as they would call it there, a voice.
Saying, you know, "Well, time of war is at an end, and you people need to join the universal, you know, we are watching you, and this is the first contact, the beginning of a new age."
Was he pretending to be some kind of a space alien?
He wasn't Churchill, which I'm doing my kind of Churchill. He was. I've listened to the broadcast, and it is spooky, but now by our standards today, it is hilariously spooky.
Like it's campy,
super campy. But you can tell that the person doing it is dead serious. Although he's serious and he's trying to do a War of the Worlds thing where they imagine they're going to spook everybody and people are going to run out into the streets and think that UFOs have arrived.
He doesn't appear to have any kind of ideological aim. It's not like Wake Up People.
Yeah, it's ideological in that he wants – his desire is not to create – panic in the streets as much as it is to wake up people to the idea that there's a universal commonality between human beings. And
he's Starfleet.
Yeah. And he wants to put an end to war. It's obviously a hoax, but I think this was during the era 1977 when all it took was a little bit of theremin music and the suggestion that there was a Bermuda Triangle. And
no child could sleep.
Yeah, none of us could sleep for a week, right? And so it was in that family of and television broadcasts were somewhat sacrosanct.
Right. I mean, that's the main taboo you're seeing broken. You thought the BBC was all powerful because here's the guy you see every night. And nope.
And it,
Vrilon is more powerful than this guy.
And it was, I think partly that worked in their favor, or they expected it to, in that to have enough broadcasting power, to have enough wattage to override the BBC.
Because there it's an arm of the government, right? That's state TV.
Right. So the only people that could do it were UFOs. Now, that alone is hilarious to imagine that UFOs could come to our world, but not have enough broadcasting power to also put video up to like completely override the BBC.
It was an aesthetic choice.
Not just
they come from the dark planet.
It's Vrilon.
Was Vrilon ever apprehended?
Vrilon escaped justice.
Oh, man.
And
still out there today.
And it was a it was a contained scandal, partly because the BBC was embarrassed and never wanted it, didn't report on it, didn't if you weren't watching the program at the time, you wouldn't have heard about it later, except, you know, sort of underground gossip, but it didn't, you know, it didn't make the newspapers, and it was because of a monolithic media control.
To this day, the British government can slap a whatever order on some story and then nobody can report on it.
Right, it's gone. The curious thing about it, as we'll see, is that as shortwave radio technology and enthusiast radio stuff became more powerful and more common, it didn't actually require a massive transmitter to overpower the BBC. It only required that you be in the right place. This was the first intrusion, and there weren't a ton of, or there weren't really any documented attempts to override the television.
There were no copycats.
No copycats until about 10 years later, in the mid 80s, there was a little rash of this kind of event.
Did you have a little rash in the mid 80s?
I had more than a little rash. I had this terrible condition where I licked my fingers all the time and I put hand lotion on all the time. I think it was some puberty thing.
We were all nervous about Reagan.
My skin started peeling. It was awful.
But that's probably unrelated to
these intrusions. Well, no, microwave radiation. It was one of the things I considered. The rise of what we called visions in Anchorage, but home box office and Showtime, where they were the first alternative to regular television.
Predated VCRs even. This is the way to watch movies in your house. For the first time in history, you could watch a movie without waiting for it to show up with commercials on NBC Friday Night Movies.
And it required that you have an antenna put up on your house and that you subscribe, that you pay the fee. And it's amazing to think that enough people did it, enough people wanted it, and that there was money to be made in charging a subscription that made it worth sending trucks around and putting antennas up on all these people's houses. But there was. In fact, in fact, there were Visions trucks, very identifiable. You would see a Visions truck parked out in front of somebody's house and say, wow, they're getting Visions.
Alaska's a long, dark winter.
You know, Dad is, must be really raking in the oil money or something for them to be able to get Visions.
There's just not a lot of options, not a lot of entertainment options back then.
Almost zero entertainment options. That's right.
That's what we called it. That was the slogan. It said on the Alaska license plate. It said almost zero. Alaska, almost zero entertainment options.
Almost zero options. In 1986, in the spring of 1986, an HBO broadcast in Florida was interrupted by what we used to see, which was a sort of rainbow, like color palette.
The test pattern.
Test pattern screen came up in the middle of a broadcast of Falcon and the Snowman. The great.
See, this is why you were paying a premium price for HBO back then, because you could watch movies like The Falcon and the Snowman, which would play six times a day.
And this was April of 86. So I was working at Catch-22 at this time. This was my senior year in high school. I was a Catch-22 employee.
Are you saying you have an alibi?
In fact, I do have an alibi. In fact, you know, I worked the night of my senior ball. I went to senior ball with my date, went to some parties after the, you know, the dance was over in a white limo or whatever with my prom date. And then I went, I said goodnight to everybody.
You went to work.
Left my date in her ball gown at some party with my friends and went to work at Catch-22 and worked in my prom tuxedo.
You played Kenny Rogers and Run DMC videos.
Right, until 9 o'clock
and Richard's promise held. You never appeared on camera.
Unfortunately for Richard, I did appear on camera because no one was watching at 5 o'clock in the morning. And so I routinely turned the camera on. I didn't do it for long because I didn't want somebody to turn their VCR on and bust me. But, you know, I would show up on camera and I'd be like, hey, you're listening to, you know, you're watching Catch-22, Anchorage's only music video station. And then I would close
the John Roderick Intrusion. That could have been your first band.
The John Roderick Intrusion.
Everybody welcome the John Roderick Intrusion.
Well, on this fateful night in 1986, this test pattern showed up and it had some writing on the test pattern that said, that was from an intruder by the name of Captain Midnight. Mm. Now we didn't at first. The residents there did not know who Captain Midnight was. No one knows who he were or what he were doing. And Captain Midnight was upset that HBO had raised their prices. And Captain Midnight's little test screen said, good evening, HBO, from Captain Midnight. $12.95 a month? No way.
What a subversive. With all the political causes to be mad about in 1985, this guy doesn't care about Nicaragua. He doesn't care about acid rain or NATO. He is worried about HBO jacking up prices at $1.50 a month.
And what it turned out, he was busted. What it turned out was that he worked... His name was John McDougal, and he worked as a cable uplink technician.
Oh, it's a inside job.
Yeah, he worked for the Central Florida Teleport Uplink Station.
Yeah, CFTUS, sure.
and he was mad because he had a side job where he installed HBO equipment in the local community and. HBO raised their prices, and he was afraid it was gonna cut into his installation business.
This is when you turn into one of those guys that gives people illegal free cable, and then it's good for the market when prices go up.
Right? He should have wandered around and said, hey kid, hey fellow kids, come
he's
here.
He's in a van, and he's got, hey, I've got some free HBO here that I'm trying to unload.
Just put the key in the back.
We just had too much HBO at our event.
So this was the first documented case in the United States of somebody intruding on a television broadcast.
Isn't it so funny that as a culture, we're like, you know what sacrosanct, you know what our holy place, our temple, our Jerusalem is? it's the public airwaves.
That's right. Above all else.
Above all else, do not touch our television.
Now, do you remember Max Headroom, the titular lead of our story?
I do. He had a short-lived TV series, mm-hmm. which I never did see.
It was British. The original idea.
Right?
Yeah, it was from the UK.
It's some kind of British-American thing, or that's what I assume because the actor was Canadian.
Right.
And usually that happens when...
it's a British-American thing. And, you know, if you take a British mom and an American dad, you get 50%? A Canadian.
Somebody who talks like an American but says serviette instead of napkin. But I remember he was omnipresent. Even if you never watched the TV show, you would hear about this kind of cartoonish cyberpunk guy because he was on the cover of Newsweek.
Yep.
He was in ads for New Coke, which tells you everything you need to know about Max Headroom.
Max Headroom was, like a lot of things that came from the UK, he was it had a very subversive origin story. Max, the idea of Max Headroom was that he was a television personality, an anchor, a news program mm-hmm. anchor in a world, a future world, not very far in the future. In fact, only 20 minutes in the future.
Not like our listeners.
Not like the Omnibus.
Who are 20 million minutes in the future.
But it was he lived in a media environment, and one might say presciently, lived in a media environment where there was, where it was all television all the time. We were all on television.
Good thing that didn't happen.
Television was, like if you were too poor, you got subsidized televisions because we all needed to be on TV. But somehow he got absorbed into, what it was his intelligence. The newscaster's intelligence was uploaded into, this was before there was a web.
He predicted the cloud.
Yeah. Uploaded and became the sentient character, Max Headroom, who was fighting for the resistance. You know, it was a culture jamming.
Now, if you've never seen Max Headroom, you have to understand that he looks like a computer-generated image, kind of like something you would have seen maybe on the Brother or the Money for Nothing video
right.
at the time.
But this was before the technology allowed right. for that.
At least not affordably, you know, at British Doctor Who levels of. So in charmingly low-tech BBC science fiction fashion, it's just a guy wearing a bunch of angular makeup.
And plasticized, right? He had a plastic
yes,
suit on.
He looks shiny, and he's in front of a background that's supposed to look like a pixelated computer rendered background, but it's not.
Right.
It's just a hand animated old timey fashion. And it's actor Matt Frewer, who, you know, futurelings I'm sure remember from Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, mm-hmm. or he's on Orphan Black now. But
still out there, still getting work.
Still getting work. Good job, Matt.
And not in porn. He didn't slide down in a porn. He made it up. Climbed the ladder.
But he's just a guy goofing around in front of a screen in kind of herky-jerky ways, video enhanced, that make it look like he's computer animated.
He's computer animated and that has intruded on our program, right? He's glitchy and there's a little bit of kind of static incorporated into it, like, wow, we interrupt your show for...
There's video effects.
Headroom.
His characteristic talk is that he's stuttering a bit. But it's really just because they're replaying a few frames over and over to make it look like...
Yeah, it's jittery,
the culture
right?
is being jammed.
What the hell is going on here?
And it became... He became pervasive in the culture because it resonated. It struck a note with people that... that we were becoming there was now 100 channels, or there were 100 channels of different media options. Most of them were sports, as now. But
the billiards channel.
But MTV was considered something that was destroying our youth and introducing people in the heartland to R&B music and New York City DJs were suddenly talking to us, even in such far-flung locations as Anchorage.
Downtown Julie Brown had a British accent.
She did.
Is that what
she was
you
a
want,
black
my
lady.
Friends? Is that what you want, my friends?
And they were...
Someone who's both black and British?
If you watched MTV all night long, maybe you would see that Captain Sensible video one time. but it was seen to be undermining... society by the usual culprits who are looking for things that are undermining society.
But Max Headroom was very quickly co-opted.
He was co-opted.
He's selling us Coke.
More people prefer the new refreshing taste of Coke over Pepsi. Sweating?
He became a pitchman for New Coke, the Pepsi-like Coke product that only lasted. New Coke lasted even less time than Max Headroom.
That's why it's so funny that they chose, you know, they're picking Max Headroom thinking this is youthful, it's tech forward.
Right.
This is the future. And within 6 months they had both disappeared into the memory hole forever.
But so Max Headroom arrived on the scene even before Captain Midnight. And so the idea that this was possible was prevalent in the culture, maybe not prevalent, but those of us who were on the cutting edge of the new video future could picture this as a source of rebellion,
yeah,
right?
It's subversive satire,
because you could see a world in which the Reagan administration was controlling access to media, and all you were given were Falcon Crest reruns, and this was, I mean, punk rock was happening. Second wave punk rock was happening as an alternative subterranean culture throughout the United States, and there wasn't a ton of access to mainstream media. If you weren't aware of the Dead Kennedys, it's not like you were going to get exposed to it on your local news program. And the only way maybe to get to people was to break into the TV.
Max Headroom was named after a sign, right? There was, the creator saw a sign that said, you know, Max Headroom 9 feet or whatever, right. You know, it's just short for maximum.
3 meters, of course, because it was from the United Kingdom.
Right. So it's fully, it's Dada, basically. It's a meaningless kind of fun name.
But Max Headroom, there was another intrusion into cable broadcasts, and it happened in September of 87. And that was now maybe the reverse of what you would expect, which was late night pornographic cable, the American Ecstasy Channel with three X's, the American XXXtasy Channel.
It seems fake. There were multiple low-rent competitors.
It's like the American KKK channel, except it's the American XXXtasy channel. Their broadcast of some dirty porn was
the worst kind.
Was interrupted by some Bible quotes.
Wow. So this is already enough of a trope that people can do the postmodern twist on it.
Well, not yet, right? This is only the third time it's happened.
But that's very early for someone to be like, well, we've already seen the crazy subculture thing replacing the monolith. Let's do the other thing.
So there was a text appeared on the screen.
I'm assuming it's not a sincere believer.
Unfortunately, you are wrong.
Oh!
Appeared on the screen, thus saith the Lord thy God, remember the Sabbath and keep it holy. Repent, for the kingdom of heaven is at hand.
This is just some televangelist with good hacking skills?
So it was, by this point in time, the FBI and the FCC were concerned about this because it really did look like a potentially seditious, if you could just interrupt the regular broadcasts with whatever crazy alien conspiracy or apocalyptic Bible verse, what was sacred in America? You know, that could potentially be dangerous.
It became a fictional trope around this time of, you know, in movies, you'd often have the villain be able to do this kind of thing. I'm the Joker speaking to you on every channel.
It did, in Christian Slater, and it became, yeah. And in fact, even into our contemporary movies, right? It still is a trope.
It's just taken for granted that the supervillain can appear on every channel at once if he needs to.
That's right.
Hold Gotham hostage.
And that is that movie idea and that cultural idea, really, it only has these very few, this few handful of antecedents. The FBI and the FCC investigated, and again, the thing that caught Captain Midnight, the reason that the FBI was able to identify him was that the typeface he used to say, "Good evening, HBO, $12.95 a month, no way," it was a typeface that could only be generated by a small amount of equipment. And they recognized the typeface, or the FBI, you know, got to the bottom of it and realized, hey, only the Central Florida Teleport Uplink Station has that key code machine that generates that font.
If you were ever in law enforcement, wouldn't you want to be a font cop?
I know.
That would be my dream.
Isn't that so fun?
That's
just like, wait a minute.
That's not Garamond. That's Palatino. Bring him in, boys.
And that's what happened here. Also, they realized that that there was some quality to the text, the shape and quality of the text that directed their attention to the Christian Broadcasting Network. And there was an engineer,
Captain Thessalonians.
His name was Thomas Haney, and Thomas was a Christian Broadcast engineer who, at the end of his shift, just sort of turned his equipment over to the left and jammed the signal of the porno broadcast that was coming out of the neighboring building.
It kind of implies that anybody with access to an antenna back then just could have made small modifications and just done this. There were hundreds or thousands of private enterprises that had the power to do this.
Well, so there were, in a lot of cases, if it was a hardwired signal, right, you wouldn't have this option. And I suppose you could get your little dish and put it up in front of your neighbor's vision antenna and jam his signal, but you couldn't
that's if you're trying to do some, you're trying to drive your neighbor mad.
Hey, Bob.
Change your will. Trim your wisteria.
Your dog is barking. There was a lot of, it was beginning to proliferate that there was microwave transmission was a component of how television stations did their business, and we'll see in the now finally topic of today's show, in the Max Headroom intrusion.
Oh.
Which happened
happen 55 minutes into the show.
Which happened in this same year, in November of 1987.
So just a couple months after Thomas Haney strikes a blow for Jesus.
That's right. On the television station WGN, which is a major station in Chicago, Illinois, for those of you in the future who are like, Chicago, you mean of the Midwestern Space Alliance?
At the time, WGN was kind of a trailblazing, trend-setting station. They were just a local Chicago station that had decided they could be a regional, Midwestern, and national station
right.
if they started putting their programming on satellites.
And when we had cable TV, when cable TV was introduced into Anchorage, we had WGN as one of the channels.
And it was very confusing. You're like, why do I have this one Atlanta station and this one Chicago station?
Yeah, and the one from Boston, right? Yeah. There were a handful. Oh, and you could watch Crazy Eddie commercials because you had that one from New York too. But at 9 p.m. during the news program in WGN, suddenly the broadcast was interrupted, not by some little like test pattern screen with a complaint about cable prices, but with Max Headroom.
Finally, one of these with production values.
And the production values were low. It was a guy in a Max Headroom mask.
Was it a commercially available? Could you buy Max Headroom masks?
Yeah, it was a Halloween costume.
Because Fuhrer went through 5 hours of makeup every morning to put the forehead on.
Yeah, this was just a rubber mask, okay. But it looked convincingly enough like Max Headroom. And instead of an animated background of sketchy digital lines, the background was a corrugated metal door that looked very much like the metal.
Anything with stripes, I guess.
And someone was holding the door and moving it randomly behind him.
So there's multiple people in this gang.
So that it looked like – it really looked like – I mean a weird – like in some ways, an even spookier version of Max Headroom. Like, what am I watching here? And it intruded into the sports broadcast, completely overpowering the WGN broadcast.
Completely overpowering the Bulls score or whatever.
Right. And it came with audio, which was just intrusive static. And the guy in the Max Headroom mask was sort of like, wah, kind of
flailing
while the screen in the background, you know, or the corrugated metal door in the background moved around. It was unsettling.
Yeah, that's a horror aesthetic that persists today in, you know, things like The Ring, where just there's something about lo-fi, low production value work.
Yeah.
Like cheap art does not look hokey. If done right, it looks very scary.
Yeah. So
something about our brain wants nice polished art.
And this did not belong.
Right.
It only lasted 20 seconds because the team of engineers at WGN were on the case.
A crack team.
And
at the superstation.
They switched their frequency to a different repeater. Now,
do you think that means they already had a plan in place? If this ever happens to us.
They had a plan in place in case they had a redundancy because in case something went wrong,
yeah.
Right? In case there was an outage, they could switch over to a different transmitter. So it bears explaining. The WGN studios were in, you know, a building in North Chicago, but in order to broadcast to the greater Chicagoland area, their big transmitter, their big antenna, was on top of the Sears Tower, and on top of the John Hancock Building, and on top of the Sears Tower. And the way the system worked was they produced their television show, and then they beamed it to a repeater on top of the big building, where the real power of the transmitter resided, and then it was. Then
this is the secret of the pyramids. America's tallest building opened its third eye and blasted the superstation and the White Sox game all over the country.
That's right. And so in order to take over those airwaves, all someone had to do was get closer to the John Hancock Building with a powerful enough signal that
It's basically just a line of sight thing.
Yeah.
You just have to point it.
And if they pointed it at the receiver, all they had to do was be slightly closer because WGN didn't have a massive transmitter sending that signal up. Mm-hmm. They just had to get in the way and send a slightly stronger signal that was stronger only because it was more proximate.
You just have to be the fan on the Jumbotron who realizes that they can jump up in front of the row that you're currently seeing and do a little dance.
Yeah.
It's that on a media level.
And you needed to be sophisticated enough to know about all this and to know where to be able to figure out what the line of sight was and figure out how to get in between it. But that was all it took. And it fooled the larger transmitter into broadcasting the signal that was closer. And so the WGN engineers, you know, just switched over, sent their signal to a different broadcaster, and they switched that. And so after 20 seconds, the initial Max Headroom intrusion was thwarted.
So we don't know what they had planned. If they thought they had 5 minutes, maybe they did have a message to read.
Well, so we do know, because it was only a few hours later that in the midst of... And you saw this in the future. You foresaw it in the midst of a Doctor Who broadcast on the local PBS affiliate. Suddenly, the signal switched over.
Oh, he's on a different channel.
Max Headroom.
Fake Max Headroom is the king of all media.
And you can see in the broadcast the sort of those weird sort of tape skittish lines that indicate that it is a VHS tape.
Yeah. The tracking.
The tracking is skews a little bit at the very start of it. So, you know, it's not a live broadcast. And here is Max Headroom, but this time accompanied by audio in addition to the static. And he is riffing in a way that really makes you... really pinpoints exactly what you were saying was it was so amateur, so Dada in a kind of self-conscious mid-80s punk rock idea of what a Dada intrusion might be, that the amateurness of it, the strangeness of it made it weirder and seem worse.
The brain wants order. The brain wants to impose all stimuli, a system on all stimuli, so we understand, so we categorize it into a way so we understand what we're seeing and we know what to expect next. And when we can't do it because the input is so absurd, it's very unsettling because we don't know. Anything could happen now.
He hums the theme to the short-lived television cartoon Clutch Cargo. He kind of disparages a WGN sportscaster.
Oh, he got specific Chicagoland references.
He holds up a can of Pepsi and says the catch line for New Coke.
Oh, that's crazy.
Yeah, a little bit of culture jamming there. He has a dildo on his finger and waves it around. Again, the background is...
we should emphasize for the future, the real Max Headroom never played with dildos.
As far as we know, never on, camera, on screen. Never on screen.
Yeah. On weekends, that's his business.
And then the scene cuts to a slightly different vantage point where what we, I guess, can assume is Max Headroom turns around and his pants are down and we see his bottom. And then...
So there's cuts in this.
Yeah, well, one cut.
He's made a movie.
A woman in a maid costume appears. We don't see her face. And proceeds to swat him on the butt with a fly swatter. While he says, you know, give it to me, baby. There's a little bit of swearing. And this intrusion lasts for 90 seconds. Because no one at the PBS station, there were no engineers on duty. They had just
turn on 6 hours of Tom Baker era Doctor Who, and we're going to call it a night.
So I know what this is like. When I worked at Catch-22, and I apologize to Richard, sometimes around 5 o'clock in the morning, I would get very sleepy. And we had a videotape that was about 20 minutes long of Ricky Skaggs at the Telluride Bluegrass Festival playing, or it was, you know, it was Hot Rise and the, you know, Buttermilk Biscuit band. And they were playing a very extended jam, bluegrass jam. And when I needed a cat nap, I would put this bluegrass, you know, we were only supposed to play 30 or 3 minutes of it, but I would put it in and just let it play. And would lay down on the studio floor and catch a little catnap. So I know what this is like, and I know that at this PBS station, that's what they were doing. And they had a long, long run of Doctor Who, and it's PBS, so there weren't commercial breaks, and there was nobody minding the store. So this 90-second intrusion wasn't thwarted by any engineer.
To this day, I noticed once that a local music radio station here in Seattle put on Teenage Riot by Sonic Youth an awful lot. And I asked somebody once at KEXP, "Why do you guys play Teenage Riot? I mean, I love Teenage Riot, but why are you playing that so much?" And they're like, "Oh, it's 7 minutes. You know, the album version's 7 minutes long. We play that when the DJ needs to go to the bathroom."
Right.
So every time I now hear Teenage Riot on the radio, I can't help but imagine somebody in a restroom.
Somebody's
stall.
Going to the bathroom. Yeah. That's right. But this event was it made the news. Unlike the BBC, this was. Enough time, we were in the middle of this cultural moment where, as you say, this, I think, was a big part of the inspiration of a generation of people that imagined this was how the revolution was going to start.
Hackers.
Now that, it was the dawn of media hacking, and it was widely reported. It was in the newspaper, it was in the Chicago Tribune, it was... People talked about it on the evening news.
Well, back then, all the big influencers in the culture were huge Doctor Who fans. Mm. So they were furious.
In fact, a lot of the response, the only reason we have documentation of it is all the Doctor Who fans that were taping the show.
Home taping. You wanted to have your, remember this? You wanted to have your own home library of your favorite shows.
And there were a lot of people really pissed off that 90 seconds of an episode of Doctor Who was missing. Now they had this great cultural artifact on their VHS tapes.
But they wanted 90 more seconds of the Dalek men.
They were furious. So the FCC and the FBI, now having solved the earlier criminal enterprises of the CBN hacker and the Captain Midnight incident. They really wanted to go after the Max Headroom team. And there were, you know, there was a kind of an aggressive pursuit of it, but the head of the FCC was too timid, didn't really pour his money or his attention into the investigation. And the team behind the Max Headroom intrusion escaped. There was a lot of hullabaloo about it. And this was, there weren't a ton of laws on the books prohibiting this kind of thing. One of the things that was confusing about the CBN case was that the only thing they could charge him with was unlawful, unlicensed intrusion into broadcast. But he was licensed. he was a licensed broadcaster.
Was that his defense?
you know, even Pat Robertson came to that guy's defense, if you can imagine. Pat Robertson intruding into a cultural debate.
Well, yeah, but he's only going to want that one particular case. He doesn't want the maid with the fly swatter coming on to the 700 Club.
No, he doesn't.
If he did, he could invite her.
And hard to believe that the perpetrators of the Max Headroom intrusion had any. I mean, there's no message. It's just gibberish. The only message is we can do this.
Yeah, the medium is the message, right? Like your programming is not safe.
But it's not even, he didn't even, like the Virilin guy at least was aware of, self-aware of that idea, right? We are intruding on your broadcast.
We control the horizontal.
Whereas Max Headroom is just, he's just goofing.
That makes it scarier. It doesn't even trouble him that what he's done. Like, he's got this opportunity, and what's he going to do? Literally any dumb thing he wants.
Right, just totally waste your time and be a weird bummer. Like, and they've recorded it in advance and made an edit.
They could have made anything.
Yeah.
They've got a camcorder.
Yeah.
And they made that.
Yeah, they could have done a, you know, 90 seconds of truly seditious material. You know, the Reagan administration is whatever. And then
they could have thrown darts at a picture of Thatcher, and nope.
To this day, we do not know. Now, the statute of limitations on this crime ended 5 years later.
And nobody came forward to
no
say.
No one came forward. And this became somewhat legendary in hacker culture. This was the early dawn of there was a sort of nascent internet at the time. Mm-hmm. And people were talking about it. It was on message boards. It was an exciting kind of, you know, like an example of maybe what was possible among these. I mean, the early internet people and the ham radio people kind of overlapped a little bit. I don't mean to disparage either camp.
They weren't all cool like Matthew Broderick in War Games. They didn't all have our cute Ally Sheedy girlfriends.
And that was, you know, War Games was another influence on this, you know, the idea that you could,
It seemed like magic to most of the people seeing that movie, that you could put your phone in a little cradle and then you could talk to government agencies. No, how would that even work?
Right. Get, not only talk to them, but get in and screw with them. Mm-hmm. The revolution will be televised.
So why do you think they never came forward? I guess my theory would be that it ruins the trick.
It ruins the trick.
There's an air of mystery.
You'd have to explain why you were so dumb.
Oh, do you think they're vaguely embarrassed now?
there was a whole thread for a while on Reddit where someone came forward and said, I was a member of this weird hacker culture in Chicago at the time, and I think it was Mr. J and his brother Q. But the suggestion was that they were like, you know, kind of profoundly socially awkward brothers and one of them was very much on the spectrum, mm-hmm. On the spectrum to the degree that it made it difficult to communicate, you know, with regulars.
Well, he found a woman in a maid costume.
And there was a lot of speculation about whether or not it was these two brothers, but with a lot of investigation into it, it seemed just very unlikely, not their aesthetic and you know, kind of weirdly improbable.
But there is still some kind of unsolved mysteries movement of trying to unravel who and why?
There is. There was a punk rocker by the name of Eric Fournier who had a band called the Blood Farmers, who made a series of videos starring a character of his own called Shea St. John, and it was perceived that there were a lot of similarities production wise, but all of his bandmates dismissed the possibility. They say he didn't have any of this capability. This wasn't his trip. He's since died, so can neither confirm nor deny.
Well, that's what I'm thinking. Like at some point, you know, in 30 years, somebody's going to be going through granddad's basement after he, you know, died of liver cancer, and they're going to find a Max Headroom mask and a fly swatter sitting in a box somewhere. And we're finally going to know.
They'll find all the alternate takes that they rejected for making too much sense.
And that concludes the Max Headroom Intrusion, entry 767.JB2415, certificate number 29692, in the omnibus. Now, listeners, we hope that this transmission has reached you uninhibited by culture jammers and hackers. If so, you should probably know that in our time, John and I disrupted the culture with our hilarious social media commentary on the events of the day. He was at John Roderick on all the things. I was at Ken Jennings on fewer things. Jointly, we were at Omnibus Project. Our email, for those who wanted to contact us, if anybody wants to confess that they were the Max Headroom killer, or not killer, but Doctor Who interrupter.
You know, we did hear from the geniuses behind the Church of the Subgenius.
It's true.
Yeah.
So this could be the thing now. We could solve for the future all these unsolved mysteries. Please send your confession to theomnibusproject@gmail.com, or if you want to write it with a bunch of weird zodiac symbols, please mail it to Omnibus Project, P.O. Box 55744, Shoreline, Washington, 98155. Others in this time who want to share your theories, please do so on the Futurelings Facebook group.
That's where you will meet Richard Hadley, Richard now lives in Minneapolis and has become a streetcar operator as a hobby. He's a hobbyist.
As a hobby?
Yeah. He also takes pictures of old neon signs throughout the Midwest. He's still a character after all this time.
That's exactly what I would expect. So say hi to Richard on the Facebook group, or go to Reddit and share your Max Headroom theories on the Futurelings subreddit. Mm-hmm. If you would care to contribute to helping Omnibus Project become a mass media sellout that has no time for...
Try new Coke.
Did you hear that? What was that?
New Coke.
To fund our amazing culture jamming, we welcome all material donations at patreon.com/omnibusproject.
Also, did you mention our mailing address?
I did.
Okay.
We're good. You were just too busy. You were too busy trying to think of weird sound intrusions.
Futurelings, from our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization survived. We hope and pray that the catastrophe we fear may never come.
But fear.
If the worst comes soon, this recording, like all our recordings, may have been our final word. But if Providence allows, we hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.